Now we'll talk about Biden's State of the Union address. We'll go over it. You know, it wasn't anything new, aside from at the very, very end, right? It sounded honestly a lot like the last State of the Union. You know, in a very strange way, it was almost as if I was listening to the same State of the Union, except Marjorie Taylor Greene didn't stand up and boo him. But yeah, we'll just go over some things he talked about. He started off, you know, talking about Ukraine and how Putin won't stop with Ukraine and we have to help Ukraine. You know, he was met with thunderous applause. And the joke that me and my friends were having as we were listening to this was, why are they clapping about hearing that Ukraine's going to be destroyed? Why are they clapping at that? But you know, maybe that's a part of the power shift here. You know, with Victoria Nuland out and the China hawks in Ukraine, it's over. It's over. Even though we're saying that we're gonna stay, and we're saying we're in it. Actually, notice that no one is saying that for as long as it takes stuff anymore. No one's saying that anymore. Maybe that we're actually not gonna be there in it for as long as it takes. I mean, we're not gonna get help them as long as it takes. You know. But I'll digress. Talk about Ukraine. He said that there are no American soldiers in Ukraine and that he was determined to keep it that way. Now, I'm not entirely sure why he felt the need to say that, because no one said that. Only the kinds of people that I listen to would even suggest that there are mercenaries on the ground. There are contractors on the ground in Ukraine. Which there are, verifiably. You saw at the beginning of the war, there were all those volunteers, all those people who left their homes to go fight for Ukraine. Seems like so long ago, doesn't it? Remember the ghosts of Kiev? so much buffoonery that went down at the beginning of this war, but I digress. He said that there were no boots on the ground in Ukraine, that he was determined to keep it. They would, well, you know, that's good, you know. I just wish you meant it. Or at the very least, if you're going to go behind our backs and put troops there, at least learn something. Because right now, our military, I'm not convinced our military is learning all that much from their experience in Ukraine, right? We're just telling the Ukrainians, stick to the books, stick to what we tell you, do this, do that, right? And while we're so busy commanding them to fight the war the way that we would fight the war, we're not learning how to fight a modern war. At least the people in charge now aren't. They're not learning what a hypersonic missile is capable of. They're not learning the power of a thermobaric missile barrage. They're not learning how to take a dug-in fortified position while your opponent numerically outnumbers you, right? They're not learning how to fight modern urban warfare, be it from the attacker's perspective or from the defender's perspective. They're not learning anything. They're not learning the importance of artillery. They're not learning the importance of industry. They're talking about how we're gonna help Ukraine produce shells. We're gonna increase our own production and ramp up. To the point where we can produce in a month what Ukraine goes through in a day, and they call that progress. We're not learning much, if you'll notice. I know this is a bit of a tangent from his speech, but there's just so many learnable, valuable lessons to be taken from this war. And I've gone over a number of them in my episode titled The Lessons of War. And that was just from what we could observe at the beginning of the war, which is that the city remains the best, the greatest man-made defensive structure in modern warfare. Nothing beats the city as a defensive structure in modern warfare. You just can't beat it, especially a big city. You don't need a citadel anymore. The city is the citadel. Even a small town can halt an enemy army for weeks and months if you're dug in well enough. And well equipped, you can hold off a larger, superior enemy force that outnumbers you in artillery, that outguns you in artillery, outnumbers you in manpower. That if you can deny air power, you know, like again, and I don't even know if I mentioned this one in that episode. It's been 2 years now, But if you have sufficient air defense cover, and you, to the where you can deny your enemy the usage of his air force, and you force, you can force a sort of World War One and previous era infantry battle, a land battle, an exclusive land battle. If you have enough air defenses, you can neutralize enemy air power, because only someone who's suicidal is going to use his planes against an array of air defenses, which is why neither sides up until very recently have been using their air forces. Ukraine, a lot of it got destroyed in the early parts of the war, but Russia, they haven't used it much until they've sort of whittled down Ukraine's air defenses. So one of the lessons you can learn from this is that if you have sufficient air defense, you can force the war to remain on land. And to the extent that there is air power, it has to be really, really localized. That's a lesson of war. We're not learning anything. I have learned more from this than our generals have. Or at the very least, they're not implementing anything that they're learning. Like, there's so much to be learned from this war. Military commanders and generals and military planners, serious military planners, are going to be looking on this war, and it's going to be like a holy grail of knowledge on how to fight a modern war. And so many new doctrines are going to be rewritten, and you know, adjusted with the lessons of this war in mind. A lot of military theories and doctrines are being rewritten as we speak to account for what is happening in Ukraine. And we're over here learning nothing. But that's my tangent. Well, back to Biden's speech. He said no American soldiers in Ukraine. We're going to keep it that way. That's nice, but we have mercenaries there. But, you know, he's talking about officially, which is true. Officially, we don't have any soldiers there. It's just that the unofficial still brings with it the threat of getting us into a war. And he also talks about that there are those who want to walk away from our global leadership. And, you know, he's obviously talking about MAGA, you know. And that's been a sticking point of his, is like, we're going to be more involved in the world, and we're going to stay with our allies and our partners. You know, it kills me to say it out loud. It's just, bear with me. It just causes me immense pain. But, you know, that's been a major campaigning point of his since he took to the campaign trail from his basement. Which is that we're gonna be more involved in the world, not less. We're gonna stand by our allies, not abandon them. You know, all these things that sound nice to your average uninitiated voter who goes, yeah, we should stand with our friends, you know. But then when you realize, as this Ukraine conflict has done a very good job of showing us, when you realize that our allies are fucking worthless, or in the case of Gaza, when we realize that our other ally is downright genocidal, do we really need to stand by these people? Or maybe, or was that Trump guy onto something, you know? Just throwing that out there. But that's been a main campaign point of his, that we're going to be more involved in the world, not less. And he said, there are those who want to walk away from our global leadership. And, you know, and right then and there, you have the distinction between the imperialists and the nationalists. The people who want America to be a sovereign country, and people who want America to be the world's police, who want America to continue being the center of all things, the power of all powers, which again sounds nice until you realize what these people intend to do with that power. When you realize that kind of power corrupts absolutely. When you realize that being the superpower hasn't done Americans any good since we became a superpower. It really hasn't. Look at 1945 to now. It's been nothing but decline for us, which has been, you know, supplemented with prestige. It's always prestige, nothing material. It's, oh, you have increasing poverty. Oh, but we're a global power. Oh, you have lower and lower standards of living. Oh, now you can't live off of one income. You need two incomes to barely get by. Oh, food is up. Gas is up. Oh, we're not energy independent anymore. We rely on foreign nations. All this decline. Oops, your money is worthless. all this decline that we have seen. Nothing but decline. And all that it has been, you know, supplemented with is prestige. Oh, we have the biggest navy in the world. Oh, we spend more on our military than the next 10 guys combined. Oh, we're a global superpower. We spread freedom and democracy around the world. All these things that, at the end of the day, don't really mean anything to us. Like, it's nice to say, you know, oh, we do this and we do that. Yeah, our country does this. But then when you take a step back and you realize my life isn't impacted by that in any way that is positive. So what have we actually accomplished? And when you the more you dig into it, the more you realize that the empire or American global leadership doesn't do anything useful for Americans. It is a talking point that sounds good, that feels good, but doesn't do good. And that's a criticism I have of people who think the way he does. It's not even just about Biden. It's people who think this way and who endorse these ideas. We're not doing ourselves any favors by going along with this. And people say, oh, well, America's sacrifice makes the rest of the world safer and better, and we should just be okay with that. Well, you can only demand so much sacrifice from people for so long. And it's easier to do that when things are good for the people that you're asking to sacrifice. When things are bad, and then you're asking them, people who are already in pain, to sacrifice for others so that others can have what we don't be surprised when no one wants to go along with that. And it's sort of poetic that someone who thinks the way that Biden does will be the last person to oversee the Imperial America. He's going to be the last Imperial so-called president of this country, because the empire dies on his watch this November. Well, come this November, the empire is going to be in shambles. If for no reason other than Ukraine, like Taiwan is on deck, Israel is on deck, South Korea is on deck, Kosovo is on deck. So many lingering crises are on deck that could at any moment blow up and just nuke this empire, figuratively, no, not literally. So I think it's really poetic that Biden and people who think the way that he do are going to be the ones to oversee the end of that empire, which will be the ultimate delegitimization of them and their views, and thus will finally liberate America from this mind virus that says that we have to be everywhere all at once and we have to have the final say in everything everywhere. And we'll finally be able to go back to being a sovereign, independent country that pursues our interests, not random fake interests that are actually just the ambitions of statesmen all around the world. No. So I think it's poetic. And that's the way he thinks. He brought up how Reagan and Gorbachev, because he was criticizing the Republicans, so he brings up Reagan and how Reagan would say, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, you know. And, you know, to an extent, the Republicans are also still have that mind virus, and that's just a product of the era, because we all grew up on this. This is the America that we know, right? This is the only America that we know. No one alive has the frame of reference for what America used to be pre-empire. So a lot of people, when they think of conservatism, well, they don't think of Eisenhower, they think of Reagan. But Reagan, in the grand scheme of things, wasn't the most conservative era. You have to go back pre-New Deal. And then I think that that's actually where we're going to end up going in many ways. Now, whether or not the New Deal gets reversed in total, we'll see. We'll see. I see a massive reduction in the size of the federal government coming. It'll remain to be seen if we go back to 1900 levels, but at the very least, we're going to be going back to 1940s and 30s level type of government, the size of government in the United States. But he brings up Reagan and Gorbachev and, you know, Reagan who accelerated the Cold War, which is not a good idea, but we look at it like it was a good idea because the Cold War ended. And now we attribute to Reagan, oh, he ended the Cold War. Oh, yeah, when really it was the Soviets who chose not to fight us anymore because they couldn't afford to. It wasn't us going and putting the pressure on the Soviets. It was the Soviets had been over-militarized for too long, and the corruption that their own military-industrial complex had, you know, caused rot in their system, such that the system was falling apart. And it didn't help that they had a socialist system, which isn't the most efficient in the allocation of resources to begin with. But they were able to do it, sort of brute force it through sheer mass, because Russia at the time was a country of almost 300 million people around the collapse of the Soviet Union. So when you get to 1989, when they leave East Germany, we all go, oh, look, Reagan, he was the one, even though, you know, what was it, Bush, the senior who oversaw that, the credit goes to Reagan because he's like, tear down this wall. And he ramped up against the Soviet Union. And we, you know, in our strange way of viewing history, we view that as the good thing. Even though had anyone else done what he did, we'd view it as negative. But because the Cold War ended, because the Soviets chose not to fight us anymore, we view that as a victory. And he was a good president. He did good. And he did good domestically, too. So that's part of the reason why we view him that way. But foreign policy-wise, the Cold War was the greatest blunder we ever walked ourselves into. And at the end of the day, you can't blame Reagan for that. It's really a product of many people who came before Reagan. And so I'm not going to lay that on Reagan's feet and just say that he's uniquely bad. No, no, no. We had a really long string of people who either tried and failed to end the Cold War. I mean, Nixon almost did it by accident, trying to get deals with China and deals with Russia. And then, of course, they impeached him. But, you know, he sort of did that to himself. And, you know, Kennedy, he would have ended the Cold War just out of, you know, the fear of having gone through that existential crisis that was the Cuban Missile Crisis. So, of course, they had to shoot him. Every time we've gotten close to ending the Cold War prematurely, the guy in question is suddenly and mysteriously removed from power. So Cold Warriors, as a result, have this perception of being hawks who want to fight the good fight for America, while the people who actually sought to end that unnecessary looming disaster, 45 years of looming disaster, the people who actually sought to end that are viewed very differently. And so I find it interesting that Biden brings up Reagan and Reagan accelerating and saber-rattling with Gorbachev and the Soviet Union as a good thing. And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it makes sense because that's exactly what he's doing with Russia right now. He talks about Trump's NATO comments in light with, you know, people who want to walk away from our global leadership. He talks about Trump and his NATO comments, which, I'll be honest, Trump isn't the guy you want to be afraid of. It's the people who agree with him. Because no one would blink if we walked away from NATO tomorrow. And he talked about how Trump bowed down to dictators and it's outrageous and unacceptable. There were no wars when we had it. And it's not like America was doing bad because we were just handing out everything we had to randoms overseas. No, that's what Biden's doing. When Trump was in office, he would talk tough and make a deal, right? It was the A 1-2 combo. He would talk tough and make a deal, and he made deals with North. He was going to make a deal with North Korea. I mean, he walked across the DMZ 4 times in one day without getting shot, which puts all of our so-called experts to shame.
Right.
Made a deal with the Taliban. Got a deal with China, a preliminary deal with China. He was going to get a bigger one until COVID came along. He renegotiated a whole bunch of our trade deals. He got rid of NAFTA. Got the USMCA. He did a lot of negotiating for a guy who was supposed to be the worst man ever. So, and it's sort of, as we come up on the end of Biden's tenure in office, this being his potentially last State of the Union address, I just can't help but compare the two. And the records of the two, as we now have records to compare. So everything that he says sort of rings hollow, especially when he tries to criticize Trump. When you realize that Trump, while he talked tough, he talked tough and got deals. Biden talks tough and gets embarrassed and humiliated, like when he went to Saudi Arabia begging for oil. Like when he said to Putin that we're not going to stand for this. You can't invade Ukraine. And then he invaded Ukraine. When he says that we're going to stand with Ukraine for as long as it takes, and the Russians just wear us down and all of NATO down with attrition because they outproduced all of us. They outproduced all of NATO. Biden's words ring hollow because of the reality that when he talks tough, he gets embarrassed. When Trump talked tough, he would get deals. And that was the difference here. And so America ended up being a winner under Trump, where under Biden, America is a loser. And that's a shame. It's a shame. Especially when you consider that these are the kinds of people who really, really want America to be involved and who say that American involvement is a necessity, but they're really shitty at being involved in the world. It's just a great irony. He talked about how Putin went to war to prevent NATO expanding, and now the irony is that NATO is expanding as if that was a good thing. But no, they believe that it's a good thing. And he talks about the Swedish, how Sweden is the newest member to join, and he welcomed the Finnish prime minister who was in the joint session of Congress. He was up in the it's not, what do you call those upper seats? There's a word for it. I almost said gallows, but I know for a fact that's the wrong word. There's a theater word for it when you're like on the second floor and you know those seats. I'm missing it. I'm probably not gonna. It's not gonna come to me by the end of this episode. So I'm just gonna go over it. But the Prime Minister of Finland was there. They tried to get Alexei Navalny's wife and the Zelensky's wife to sort of show up again together to sort of make some statement. They both declined. So you know, there goes that propaganda PR stunt, and probably because they don't like each other. But alas, we have to stand up to Putin was the message of Biden's foreign policy. No matter what the cost, no matter how much we fail, you know, just stand up to Putin, okay? Just give Ukraine money, all right? Europe is at risk. He said, if the United States walks away, we will put Ukraine at risk. We will put Europe at risk, and we'll put the free world at risk. History is watching. Now, no one bothers to comment on how the Europeans not defending themselves at all puts Europe at risk. No one wants to say that, except for Trump. Except for Trump. No one wants to comment on how Europe and on how Ukraine, going along with us, how we put Ukraine at risk by getting them into this war, for starters, and how Ukraine listening to us is what got them into it. No one wants to hold them accountable. No one wants to hold people in our State Department accountable for instigating this war and prolonging it when it could have been over in April of 2022. No one wants to say that. And then as far as the free world, well, the free world consists of a lot of countries other than the United States. And I said this earlier on in this episode when I talk about the West. I'm just so tired of this. We have to do everything for everybody else, but they get a free pass to sit there and do nothing. But if they fall and they die and they get steamrolled by some random, that is somehow the fault of the United States because we didn't stand up for democracy and we didn't stand up for freedom. And it's like, well, okay, what about the people who just got steamrolled? Did they stand up for democracy? It's like, get the fuck out of here. I can't stand this. I can't wait for all this to be so over. And it will be over when Ukraine falls. And unfortunately, that's the way it's going to go. Because, you know, we sabotaged them from day one. We sabotaged ourselves in the process. Now, Biden may or may not know that. But the people who, you know, orchestrate things behind the scenes definitely do. Which is why they're so frantic and panicked about the idea that the United States is going to walk away if Trump comes in. Oh my God, Ukraine, we have to keep giving to Ukraine. We can't allow Ukraine to fall. We can't allow Putin to win. You know, they're starting to go through the stages of grief over this Ukraine thing, if you notice, like anger and the bargaining. Oh my God, please, we'll give you border provisions if you just give us the money on Ukraine, please. Come on, guys. Britain passed the aid package. Europe passed the aid package. Come on, America. Just pass the aid package. Yeah. The desperation is sinking in, and that's how you know that this has gone nowhere, right? Because there's no reason to be getting this desperate if Ukraine was winning. There's no reason to be getting this desperate if Russia was actually on the back foot and 2 inches from death. Like, They're not going to bounce back from losing half of their military force. Remember all that? Remember how they lost 80% of their military? And I think he actually said this. Biden actually said this later on. After bringing up how January 6th was an insurrection, and he used that to say that 2020 was a legitimate election, that the people who challenged the legitimacy of that election, they were the bad guys, not the people who were put into power from by way of counting ballots for a week after the election. No, they're not the bad guys, obviously. The criminal syndicate is not the bad guys. It's the people who saw that that was not a legitimate election and who protested exercising their First Amendment. No, they're the problem, all right? Not the people who didn't provide adequate security to the Capitol, Nancy Pelosi. No. Not the police officers who let down the barricades and then let waved people into the building. No, none of them are to blame. No, J6ers, they're the insurrectionists. And they're to blame. So we'll see how that goes down when Trump pardons all these people and they tell their stories when they're free men and we're free women again. That's going to be one hell of a PR story. And one hell of a tale to tell our people when we talk about authoritarianism in the United States and how we fought off the empire. One hell of a tale to tell. Then he talked about the COVID vaccine and how it was being used to fight cancer. Okay, I'll just, I'm going to give him that, right? I'm not going to poop on him too hard for that. I'm just going to put that out there. And just, I'm going to leave that on the table. And you can pick it up. You can leave it there. You can do what you want with it. I'm just going to leave that on the table. Apparently, the COVID vaccine, according to Biden, is being used to fight cancer. We're just going to leave it there. Just going to leave it there. He said inflation dropped from 9% to 3%, the lowest in the world. Which ignores the fact, because I love the inflation arguments, right? I love how these fake economists, not that Biden is an economist or claims to be an economist, I love how these fake economists and these modern monetary and Keynesian cucks, these people who simp for a system that doesn't work, love to talk about inflation as if bringing inflation, annual inflation, from 9% down to 3% means that you've done something. No, because for all those months and all those years that inflation was in the double digits, the prices haven't come down. They're just rising at a slower pace now, because that's what inflation does to prices. It makes price go up. If inflation is positive, prices are going up. And any honest person who simply observing the buying power of the dollar can tell you that to the extent that wages have risen and in line with the economy, wages aren't keeping up with prices. Anyone can tell you that. And anyone can look at a graph of the U.S. economy and say that the economy has grown by X percent multiple times over these few decades. So why are things unaffordable to us right now? If growing at 3% matches, as long as we match our growth to the rate of inflation, then that we're okay. If that works, then why is it that people can't afford things right now? Because the economy is always growing, apparently, at 2, 3, 5%. It's always growing. So if it's a one-to-one relationship, how is it that the economy, how is it that the growth of the economy has not canceled out all this and this inflation of 2-3% every year? Oh, it's because these are not one-to-one correlations. And to the extent that the growth of the economy fights off the effects of inflation, it takes way more economic growth from a percent-to-percent basis than it takes to completely negate that by devaluing your currency. Like, for every 1% that you have every 1% inflation you have, it takes, like, double-digit percentiles in economic growth to counter that. Because you're losing buying power. It's not a measure of your economy. It's a measure of buying power, inflation. So when you inflate the currency and the prices go up, unless you have negative inflation, which is actually deflation, gaining value to your currency, unless you have deflation, unless inflation is negative, then you have not actually fought inflation. You have fought the growth of prices. See how that works? If you are not actively taking money out of the supply, or if you're at the very least just not inflating the supply of money. If you keep it steady, then economic growth can outpace inflation and gradually increasing the value of the dollar through increased economic growth and economic activity. Every dollar becomes worth more if you're not constantly dumping dollars into circulation. But if you're doing that, then you're not, economic growth can't cancel out the inflation. It's just, I love how the people talk about, oh, it went from 9% to 3%, and that's just so good. No, you haven't done anything. You haven't done anything. Nothing's gotten better. It's just not getting worse at the same pace that it was. And it's just such a dishonest argument. So dishonest. And he says, the lowest in the world. Whatever. People are still struggling, and they're still going to vote you out of office. He talked about how the CHIPS Act and investments in American industry and infrastructure are causing behind the boom in the economy, which I'll give credit, you know. I think it's a good idea for us to be investing in our economy, although the results of this remain to be seen. It's the results that matter, not just the dollar amounts. So I will give credit where credit is due. If the CHIPS Act worked out, great. That is great, and that'll at least be one good thing from his presidency. And I hope that it does succeed. But again, that's a results thing. We have to wait to see what the results are going to be, not just what the dollar value is. He talked about how the state of our union is strong and getting stronger, even as the federal government is fighting with Texas and a number of other states over the border. But, you know, to that extent, I will say that America is not nearly as divided as people like to believe that it is. So, in a sense, he is correct when he says that the state of our union is strong, in that we're not anywhere near as divided as people like to believe. Not anywhere close. So, the state of the union is alright, right? It's alright, right? But, you know, I'll leave that there. He talked about getting insulin prices down by allowing Medicare to negotiate lower prices, which is something that Trump did, specifically with the VA. So I suppose either Trump did this and he's taking credit for it, or this Trump-era policy has been translated over to Medicare instead of just the VA, which is still a good thing. Right? It's still a good thing, you know. But I just, you know, he acts like it was a unique idea when it clearly wasn't. He talked about getting a 6-week ceasefire in Gaza to get hostages home and humanitarian aid into Gaza. That would be nice if you hadn't thwarted ceasefire attempts at every step of the way in the UN. Like, and not only that, but forget the UN. We have not used our leverage over Israel at all to get any type of ceasefire, because we could end the fighting today. Just like with Ukraine, we could just stop giving Israel money and weapons. That fight ends tomorrow because they want the money and the weapons. Our government is bought and paid for by the Israeli government. You know, the greatest investment ever isn't the money we're giving to Ukraine. It's the money that the Israeli government spends on controlling ours. That's the greatest investment ever. But alas, there are so many ways we could end the fighting in Gaza. It's crazy. If for no reason other than the leverage we have over Israel. Right. We have so much leverage over them that we could end this today if we wanted to. But we don't. No one in our government does. So when he says that he's been working to get a six-week ceasefire, he's lying. He is objectively lying, because he has thwarted every attempt to get a ceasefire. Every attempt. Which is why the Israelis just press on with impunity, because they know that there's not going to be any consequence for their actions. At least, no consequences from us. There will be consequences, just not from us. He talked about building a temporary port in Gaza, and this is happening now, and I'll actually talk about that a little bit before we sign off for the day. And he said that, and then immediately says that we're not going to be sending any boots on the ground in Gaza, right? He said we're going to get a port into Gaza, right? We're going to build a new port, but we're not going to have any boots on the ground, except we're using the U.S. Military Corps of Engineers to build the port. So, are we putting boots on the ground, or are we not putting boots on the ground? Or is he just lying? I think he's just lying. lying about putting boots on the ground, not the port. The port is actually on its way, right? It's going to take 2 months to get there, which is just a subtle reminder of how far away we are from this region of the world. So when people say that we live in an interconnected world, well, it takes 2 weeks by boat to get there. So let's cool it on the interconnected world thing. But he also called for a two-state solution to Gaza. To the war between Israel and Gaza, I should say. A two-state solution, which is actually the correct position to take. So I'll give him credit for that. Now, granted, if he hadn't done everything in his power to facilitate the genocide against Gaza, maybe he wouldn't have earned the nickname Genocide Joe. So, while he's saying some good things here, he's not doing good things. And what he's saying is contradicting what he's doing. So, while I can give credit for some of the things he says, because they are the correct positions to have, the problem is that these are not his positions. And he doesn't act as though they were either. Like, he's going to lose over this Gaza issue, over the border issue, over so many issues. It's just not going to be good for him. And we can already see this manifesting itself at the ballot box when he lost the primary in Hawaii to Damn, I really don't mean to fucking clown on this guy, fucking, because the running joke is that no one knows who he is. But I legit do not know who he is. But I know, I know that he beat Biden. I'm gonna do him the service of looking up his name right now, just so that I don't do him dirty. But yeah, Biden lost. Biden lost a primary to a no-name candidate. A no-name candidate. And there were hundreds of thousands, 100,000 uncommitted votes in Michigan and many, many more across the country. Where people could do a protest vote, they did do a protest vote. Right? Who is it? Okay, so it's not going to tell me. Damn. It says that he won, but everyone said that he lost, and a big deal was made about it. I swear I'm really not trying to do this man dirty like this, but alas, I cannot find him at all, and I wish I wrote his name down. I'll get back to it. I'll just have to get back to it next episode. But yeah, so he lost the primary in Hawaii. And or was it Samoa? I think that's what it was. Let me go back. And who won the primary in Samoa? Jason Palmer. There he go. All right, it was American Samoa, not Hawaii. Okay. Biden lost the primary in American Samoa to a no-name candidate, Jason Palmer. So I'm going to give name to that no-name candidate. That doesn't happen. That doesn't happen. There is so much wrong with his campaign. And part of it is the collapse of the traditional voting demographics. So this speech is not only the end of his tenure in office, right? Not only is it representative of his tenure in office, not only is it representative of the end of the old era that has persisted since 1945, but it is also reflective, given his broader campaign performance, it is also reflective of the end of the political order inside of the United States. In so many ways, this speech, beyond its words, holds significance for its mere existence and the time and place that it exists. Because it represents the end of an era. And of a people, of a political class, who themselves are ignorant. Either ignorant or in panicked fear about what is right in front of them. A new world that doesn't include them. But alas, he says that this is the battle for the soul of this nation. those who want to bring us back and those who want to move forward, I would say yes. It's just that he's not the one moving us forward. It's MAGA. He says you can't lead America with ancient ideas. That's true. Let's let's get these ancient ideas of interventionism up out of here and go back to common sense of staying out. He says you can't defend. You have to defend democracy. Don't diminish it. Defend freedoms. Don't take it away. And he says that he sees a future for all Americans. And all that is true. It's just that we shouldn't be defending other people's democracy. Right. We should be defending our freedoms, not other people's freedoms. And there is a future for all Americans. It's just not with these people.